This is Eleanor Hatton. It's July 8th, 2001. It's 2:50. We're in Ketchikan, Alaska, and we're interviewing May Leask. So if you can go ahead and give me your name.
My name is May Irvine Leask. I was born June 4th, 1921. That makes me 80 years.
And where were you born?
And I was born in Ketchikan.
Do you have a Haida name? And if you do?
No, I don't. I don't have a Haida name. I was given a Tlingit name, but as a child we didn't remember or remember our names that they had given us.
What's your clan?
My clan is Eagle and Raven. Is that correct?
Could you explain why you're Eagle and Raven?
They mentioned that my grandfather was the eagle, my grandmother was the eagle, and they met in SJS, the starting of the school, and they couldn't intermarry with the eagle, so she had changed hers to Raven. So then that's why we have the Eagle-Raven clan.
Could you give me the names of your family, your parents, your brothers?
You mean my mother?
Your mother?
My mother's Margaret Violet Jones, her maiden name. She had married my dad, Bill Irvine, and he passed away, and of course she consequently married Otelius Olson.
And
her parents were Mr. and Mrs. Joe Jones. Her maiden name was Susan Finley, and they originally married in Sitka, but they came down to Kassan. Old Kassan, and then eventually got stuck there, and of course that's why they built their home there in Kassan.
And how about your spouse, your children, your grandchildren?
And I left home when I was about 16, 17 to go to Wrangell Institute, and consequently married Ronald Leask from Metlakatla. And we lived within this area, and then shortly after we moved to Seattle, where Sharon, my oldest daughter, was born. Of course, Ronnie was born previous to that, and I had four children. There was Ronnie, Sharon, Bob, or Robert, and Susan. And that's my family, boy, girl, boy, girl.
And where were they all born?
Susan, the three were born here in Ketchikan, and Susan, we lived in Seattle at the time, Sharon was born in Seattle.
Do you know any Haida names for your family? Do your children have
no,
any?
No, none of the children have Haida names. Okay. At the time, I guess they didn't encourage children to either speak or learn their language at the time, and of course they weren't that interested in Indian names or anything to do with Indians for that as they do now, I guess, you know, it's more popular, I guess, that
right. That
they have all their Indian dances and potlatches and what have you.
Did you speak or understand Haida when you were growing up?
I don't know where I picked up the Haida. They didn't speak much Haida, but I can understand it to this day, but I can't speak it. I can barely put words together to make it sound like, to make anybody understand.
Question when you mentioned you had a Tlingit name. Now, why did you have a Tlingit name? What was the connection?
My grandmother was from Klapwan area. She was half Tlingit and half Russian, although she absolutely refused to admit her Russian background. So that's where the Tlingit came in. Mm-hmm. So we're Tlingit and Haida. And my children, of course, consequently, are Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian. From their dad's background.
And she spoke both Tlingit and Haida?
Yeah.
Mainly?
Mm-hmm.
What places in or around Kassan?
Pardon?
What places in or around Kassan did you used to go to that were important to your family?
Oh, we used to go, I mean, spend a lot of course, planting various vegetables, mainly potatoes. We'd go out in the outlying area of Kasan. Of course, we'd go to Grindle. The whole town would move there to do their fishing. My grandfather owned a boat, and he's the one who was a packer. And he also brought his grocery store there. And consequently, the whole town moved there from Kasan.
About where in Grindle was your summer camping area?
Right in Grindle. I guess there's just only one place where they call Grindle.
Right, but where in that area? Do you remember?
It was just what we call it, just Grindle. It was just which was the whole little camping place, I guess they call it, would be Grindle. Where Grindle is now, what they call Grindle.
You said you went and you had a garden. Where was your garden?
It was about 3 miles north of Kasan, in that area, which seemed like an awful long way. I mean, we went by boat. We were able to walk if the weather was bad, you know, to bring us back to Kasan. And a lot of times they took the boat from there, the ones that maybe two people took the boat from where we were planting potatoes, and then we'd have to walk.
Now, you just planted potatoes there, or was there other things that
just
you planted?
Just potatoes, and of course there were various other families that went there that had gardens close to ours, right next to ours, in fact. And then we made a picnic out of it. I mean, we made the whole day off, you know, we brought all the family there and had picnics on the beach and built fire, and oftentimes there was always a baby in the family, and my grandfather always put up a little cradle. It was always the first thing they put. Besides, they always brought all their food, and we cooked the salmon and what have you by open fire while we were doing the planting of the potatoes.
Now, earlier you told me about how you planted the potatoes and the fertilizer. Could you tell me?
Yes, the little ones, I guess we all had our own jobs. I mean, the youngest little ones, we used to get kelp, and we used to have herring that they had solid the year before, maybe ulikans, and that's what we'd use for fertilizer. And that was the children's job, to fill in these little holes that they dug up that where they were going to plant the potatoes.
Did you go back periodically to take care
of? And of course we had to go back periodically to weed the place and make sure that there was a farm area shortly little ways from there that had a lot of pigs that ran wild, and they used to go after the potatoes, so they'd have to make sure that they watched their potatoes so the pigs wouldn't eat their potatoes that they had planted.
You talked about Grindle, and what did you used to do there?
I took care of my grandfather's store, and of course he had the boat, and he had was the fish packer, and I was the one that took care of the store while they were gone, fishing or whatever they did in their job.
So what were the other people doing?
Everybody was trolling. It was all hand trolling. You know, nobody had outboard motors, and their fishing gear was altogether different than what they have now. They didn't have fishing poles. They had the real heavy fishing gear, and of course everybody all had was in the same boat, and they all used oars to go fishing with on their little boats.
You had talked a little bit about when you went to get seaweed.
Yes, if we went to get the seaweed, and that was a big picnic in itself. We'd go getting seaweed and bring it all home to Kasan from Grindle, and then we'd dry them all on the large rocks. And that too, we made a big picnic out of it, and then we'd all take turns turning over the seaweed to dry, and it was usually on a hot day. And after they were all dried, my grandfather built a huge fire with a wired chicken wire that they laid over on top of the flames to make the seaweed crisp. And then we put it all on a big wide canvas, and they tied it up like a little package, and we'd all step on it. It would be a huge thing to break up the seaweed to various size, and of course they'd pick the big pieces on the top we'd put in one can, and it was always in a 5-gallon can, but that it was previously used for grease that they had. It was the empty, they used those empty 5-gallon cans that a lot of times they'd get coffee in even. So that's how we processed all our seaweed.
You talked too about...
And they made the cake type also. There was the three different kinds. There were two different sized seaweed that they'd have, and then they'd have that cake, what they'd call the cake, it just fit in the bottom of the 5-gallon can. And they'd press it down with boards that would be the size of the can, and they'd use weight on top, like rock or something, to press it down. And that's where after it formed its size, they'd take it out, and then I guess they'd dry it in the sunshine till it was completely dry. And then, of course, they'd use it for the winter time. You just cut it off, cut a slice off, and use it that way.
Did you get, you said you talked about trolling. So the fish that was caught in that area, did you use it for home use or did you sell it or?
Not that I remember that they, I don't remember them processing any of the salmon. It was all sold, and of course that was our main object of being there at the camp, was to fish for king salmon, and of course oftentimes it was all sold. So none of it was processed as far as I could remember, like smoking and canning at Grindle. They used to have all their sockeye packed by that time, and all the sockeye was smoked and put away by 4th of July or in that area, you know, at that time.
And where did you get that fish from?
From Carter Bay. And of course then at that time they used seine till they were restricted, and of course after a while eventually we'd have to walk all the way up to the falls and carry the salmon down. The sockeye maybe two or three at a time, depending on how many, each person, the size of the person, to pack down. But I remember the whole family would walk all the way up to the falls to get enough sockeye to can for the winter.
Then would you smoke it? Where would you smoke it?
We had a huge smoking house. It was almost, you might say, almost the size of our house. They had a huge smoking house that we smoked. Had to be hundreds of sockeye that they smoked at one time.
That was at Carter Bay?
That was in Kassam.
Oh, in Kassam, yeah, so you bring it all back?
They brought all the sockeye back. Of course, like I say, my grandfather owned a boat, so it was nothing to haul the fish back and forth or to, you know, to Kassam to can it and smoke it and salt it and preserve our salmon for the winter. And it was usually on my grandmother. She was the one that was supposed to be the expert, and she'd know where to change the salmon from hanging up on the top of the, above the fire, and know how to keep the fire so it wouldn't cook the salmon before they were dried. And she literally almost lived it till it was all done. You know, she never hardly ever changed her clothes much, just working in the smokehouse.
Right.
Yeah, it was her job that she that she loved, you might say. She just lived it. And that was Susan, my grandfather, Joe Jones's wife, my grandmother.
So she taught her children how to do the same thing?
Yes, uh-huh. Of course, naturally, we just were all helpers, so we learned as we went along without given the idea that we were being taught. You know, it was just something we accepted. We learned as we went along.
So when you were doing the sockeye, you know, throughout your, I guess, from when you could remember, what was your job?
We pitched in and we did everything we could. Everything like maybe for canning sockeye, they'd give us a bowl of salt with a spoon, and we'd fill all the cans with salt for people that. And then of course there was different ones. We'd have to pack water, and if they were going to hang the sockeye, of course there was different ones that would dip the sockeye in the salt water to with enough salt before they hang it up to dry, to smoke. Mm-hmm. So we all had our jobs, you know, everybody pitched in the large family.
With the smoked salmon, did you can it or did you get it dry enough that it was...
Well, earlier, I don't remember them putting up any kind of kippered salmon at the time. I mean, it was dried, smoked, and they had solid. And then, of course, I think in years back, I think they started having kippered salmon where they cut the salmon different, and it was usually king salmon. It seemed the king salmon was a lot, it was bigger, I guess you might say, and it was easier to cut for kippered. So then they started canning the kippered salmon. But I don't remember them having kippered earlier. They might have, but I mean, I don't remember.
I was thinking that one of the things, just to kind of back up a little bit about relations so that I make sure that I understand who all the people you are related to.
You want to stop for a second?
Yeah.
Because you thought you could turn from being Indians, which is good enough. I mean, the way things were, you know, everybody like Frederick's grandfather was white. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were so many white in the family that it was hard to think Indian. And because they didn't want us to speak Indian or Haida or living in a white man's world, which they had so many white people within the area there, with my mother marrying a white, and of course Polly married Bill. He was half Norwegian and half Hawaiian, and that sort of thing. So I can understand that at that period, but then of course now it's more popular to be Indian. You know, having every Indian artifacts are more popular, and carving and potlatches and so on and so forth, Indian blankets, and you know, very popular. I was thinking, I was looking in the display there, how much they were selling the baskets for, $600 and $700 for a little basket. It's not on, is it?
Did anybody in your family weave?
Yes, my grandmother. She tried to teach us, but then we weren't interested. And I kick myself to this day, you know, for not learning. That was my dad's mother. And of course my oldest sister, she came, they went to SJS and she learned how to play piano. And she was the one that played the piano. We had, my dad was the choir leader. And of course they practiced in our house quite often. And she tried to teach us to play piano. We weren't interested, we didn't have that time. You know, and to this day, I'm sorry, we never did learn, at least a little bit, you know, but we never did learn how to play piano.
I'll go back to the baskets.
Tell me when they turn it on.
Oh, it's on.
Oh.
Did you use the baskets for anything that your grandmother made?
Not that I know of. I guess they used some of them for picking berries. They used to make tiny little ones with little strings hanging, or you know, that from the material, and make it for the little kids to pick berries in. But outside of that, it was just for an ornament at that time to me.
Okay.
And there weren't much basket weaving at that time. There was hardly anybody weaving baskets. I suppose there was no need for it, and no interest in it, and so then there wasn't much, you know, basket weaving like there is now.
Okay, I wanted just to back up so I can make sure that we have a good understanding.
With the family background.
Yeah, who your family, brothers, sisters, aunts, cousins, sort of the relationship.
Okay, the Irvin family, my mother married her brother-in-law, so to speak. My mother had an older sister that passed away, and that they had three children, which was Mabel, Frances, and Adeline. And of course the Indian way, I guess, they encouraged the younger sibling to marry, like for instance my dad, because of the close relationship because she would be their aunt and she would treat them better as a stepmother. because she was an aunt. So that's why they made her marry my dad. And of course, my mother had four children after she married him. There was Laura Irvine, and me, I was the second, May. And the third was Bill, or William Irvine, Jr. And then there was Theodore, was Teddy Irvine. And then my dad passed away. And then she met and married my stepdad, which is Otelius Mark Olson. He was a web boss there came up working in a cannery in Kasan, because she married him. At that time, she owned a ice cream parlor. My grandfather owned a store and a pool hall, all in one building. And then they married, and she had six children, which was the firstborn was Leif Olson, and Fred Olson. And then there was John Olson, Bob Olson, Inga Olson, and the youngest was Helen Olson. So that was the Olson family. So my mother had 10 children, which was not unusual. I guess the family, everybody all had huge families.
You would ask about her aunts and uncles. So maybe your mother's brothers or sisters were?
My mother, my grandfather, they didn't have any. There was just a house full of nothing but girls and women living in our family. In fact, there must have been about maybe six or seven. There was my grandmother and my mother and my Aunt Pauline. We all lived in the same place. And of course, my half-sisters, Frances and Mabel first, and Frances and Adeline, then Laura. Then of course, when I was born, they all wanted a boy, of course, all along the way. And of course, here I come, and they said they pushed me away. And it bothered me for the rest of my life that they didn't want me, you know, because I was a girl. So consequently, my mother had six boys in a row after that showed her. And she had two girls after. So that was the family. Mm-hmm. I mean, at that time, I guess the grandparents all often lived with the rest. I mean, it was all one family. No matter if there was the grandchildren or, you know, oftentimes that they all lived in one house.
Can we start these?
Sure. Maybe about school. Where did you go to school?
You said you went to Wrangell
Institute?
Yeah.
From what grade or what age did you? Well, what did you go to school in Kasan? Was there a school in Kasan?
Well, I went to school to Kasan, but there was one year we missed. The teacher came there. She didn't like the whole layout. Of course, she lived upstairs from the school, and you had to pack water all the way up there. And of course, she had a toilet up there, but then they had to use water that they brought in to flush the toilet. And she didn't like the whole layout, I guess, the size of the town and the amount of children. But she left right after she was there, so we were without a school for a whole year. So everybody we went to school with us, we were always a year behind. In age, we were, you know, a year older than the rest of them. And then I went away to Wrangell Institute. Then I had gone to school the second year in high school, and then I married Ronald Lisk. And I lived in Metlakatla for several years till I was hospitalized in Tacoma, and forgot the name of it, Cushman Hospital. And I was there for 5 years.
Do you remember how you got up to Wrangell?
Yes, I remember we went on a, what everybody called a steamer, mm-hmm. which was a, I don't know what you call them now, but we all call them steamers. I went to Ketchikan on the Invictus, which was owned by Raymond Jones. And then from there, they put us on the steamer and went up to Wrangell.
Can you tell me about any kind of experiences that you had at school?
Nothing fantastic. other than I knew that I had, at that time, I knew I had had TB, and they treated us that way. I mean, they gave us x-rays, and I was given a lot of, we were on special diets, and they gave us cod liver oil and that sort of thing. So I knew at that time that I was going to have to eventually enter a sanatorium, because my older sister was in the sanatorium earlier with TB.
So you had TB when you were young and then later? Because I remember you saying something about getting it later, right?
Pardon?
You had TB when you were little?
No, when I was quite young, say about 16, 17 years old.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
I must have got it from my older sister, and of course, consequently, I don't know where she got it, but mm-hmm. she went to SJS, you know, and eventually she got married and lived down in Seattle, and then she ended up sanatorium there. Mm-hmm. Then eventually I went to Cushman Hospital.
You didn't tell us, you told us kind of how you met your husband. Was he going to school there also?
No, I met him at Ketchikan, which we came over quite often. We came here to Ketchikan for dances during the 4th of July and to celebrate for the fall when they used to have a what they call a playground, I guess they call it, where they have the baseball playground. Now they used to call a fair. They'd have a display like all the fairs do. They had with fruit and vegetables and an area where you go dancing, and the men would have to pay 10 cents and you'd dance with the girls. And of course they had other dances in different halls, and during the 4th of July they'd have dance, at least 3-4 huge dances. They'd call the purple bubble ball would be one dance, and of course the other one would be the confetti ball, other one would be the queen's ball, and of course naturally all the Simpson boys came from it, like that one. And he was always interested, even though I was 11 years younger than he was, but he was always asking about me and always wanting to know if I came to town, or always seemed to pick me out to dance with and that sort of a thing. So that's how I met him. And of course he knew my older sisters quite well. You know, they were older, they all knew him, they all knew the Leeks. Being that my husband's grandmother was married to a minister in Kasan. And they, through the years while they were little, his dad used to bring all the whole family on his little boat, and they'd come right to Kasan on the beach, and all the kids would jump off the boat and go up and stay with their grandmother, and they'd spent some time there. So then we saw them more or less through the years. And of course my family knew their family, so we knew them quite well, you know, their background. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Davis, because she was Ida, you know, so we knew her.
Who was the minister that...
Sam Davis.
Okay, so there was somebody married mm-hmm. to that person.
And then, of course, eventually, I guess they closed up everything there in Kasan, the cannery, and mm-hmm. there was hardly anything left there to stay with, so then they moved to Heidelberg, like a lot of the people did. Mm-hmm. Like the Bronoviches, they all moved to Heidelberg.
Do you remember what year they closed the cannery?
No, I don't, I'm not, because they closed it, and after a while eventually they opened it again.
Oh, okay.
And then it ran, and then of course they had it open for, they imported razor clams from Canada. And my second year and going to, or first year going to high school, they sent for us. I hated to come home, but they insist that we come home because they wanted us to make, it was a money-making thing they thought, so they brought Julie and I home to work in the, what they call the clam cannery at the time.
When you were growing up in Kasan, just kind of thinking back on those times, what are some memories that you have that kind of just stand out?
The memories were all happy memories. I mean, all the children got together, and all the children, there was no fighting, so to speak, no jaw fighting or no quarreling between the children. We all seemed to get along, whether they were tiny tots or teens. We all played together. We all played hide and seek. We all played baseball. We even made a big deal of, there was a hill there with nothing but grass, and it was a big thing. We just rolled down on those things, and that we spent the whole evening just doing that. You know, I mean, we made all our own fun and we just enjoyed ourselves growing up. And I don't remember of ever being dissatisfied with being in Kasan, where there was, you might say, nothing to do. But we all kept ourselves pretty occupied, and nobody seemed dissatisfied with, you know, our own entertainment. We had little radios, you know, and it was a big thing that anybody that owned a radio, that we were able to listen to radio.
Who were your playmates?
Like, our playmates that I vaguely remember now would be, there was the Griffins lived there. They had a big family. And then, of course, there was David Peel. He was one of the oldest. They had a huge family, and there was Bronoviches. And, of course, your family was the Joneses, who lived up on the hill. And, of course, there was us with our big family. And there were several, like the Griffins, they were all white family. They lived there for many, many years, and of course we all grew up together. And then there was Bernards, they had some children there. And then there was Youngs. I guess you remember a lot of the Youngs, like Betty Young, Carolyn, and her dad was Bob Young and Eliza Young. The kids all grew up there. They all lived there. So there was quite a few children there that we grew up with. Maybe I didn't mention them all. I can't recall to see who they all were, but I'm just trying to visualize in my mind who, when we were taking school pictures, who we all were, you know, when we were taking pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Dressed up they used to be, you know.
Church was kind of social then, huh?
Yeah.
You weren't supposed to see this, yeah.
Can I put this on?
Sure. We were trying to sneak because she was telling good stories.
Yeah.
Earlier you had talked about the piano that was in your house and the choir used to come over and practice. And who was playing the piano again?
My older sister, Mabel. When she went to SJS, she learned how to play the piano. And of course, which was a must because at that time my grandfather bought the piano purposely for choir. My dad was the choir leader, and they used to practice in our house quite a bit. And of course, it was always a social thing. They either they always had a coffee time, and they always whipped up soapberries, and it was, like I say, a social evening after the choir practice, you know. And I remember as little kids that we used to peek in and see all the grown people there practicing in the choir. And they used to travel an awful lot. They used to go to Canada and Metlakatla and various places on, I don't remember the boats, but they used to take a boat and they'd go to various places with the choir.
Did anybody play any other kind of anything else besides
there
piano?
There was a, I guess even before I was born, they had a band, a great big band. According to the pictures that I've seen, my dad was one of the, he played a bass horn. In fact, we still had it up in the house when I left there years ago. So they all played in a band, I guess, similar to what they had in Metlakatla. And of course, I suppose it was all competitive too, that one band over the other from a different various villages, I suppose. And I guess there were a lot of people there that, according to the pictures that I had seen, that they had a lot of people playing in the band.
What church was in?
Presbyterian church. It was always a Presbyterian church. There was no other church.
And the minister was?
Sam Davis.
Mm-hmm. Was he the first minister that was there?
That I could remember of, but there was various preachers that came there as guests. You know, like maybe on the Princeton, they always had someone come from Sitka or other villages came there to preach. like they do in all other little towns, that they had visiting ministers.
Did you used to live by the cannery at some point?
And when they had the cannery there, they opened the cannery after having it closed for so many years. They opened the cannery, and of course we, the whole family all worked in the cannery, so we moved to our vacant house that was right living, we lived right across the Filipino house, what we call the Filipino house, so it was closer to the cannery. So my mother and the rest of us wouldn't have that far to walk. So we lived there, and of course the bears never saw or smelled so much food, I guess, from the cannery, and I imagine from the Filipino house, so we were troubled with a lot of bears at the time, with getting into our garbage and walking underneath the roads and stuff, the streets, you know. There was always bears we used to be afraid of, going to and from work late at night, working in the cannery.
Did you work in the cannery?
Oh yes, I worked in every part. I started working in the cannery when I was 13 years old. We went over to Skullarm, that was the only cannery in that area. So we all went over to live in little cabins. Of course, I think Laura was married to Raymond at the time, and I was only about maybe 15, 16, I don't remember, 15 I guess. And I worked in the cannery all summer long, and we didn't get paid much. I think it was maybe 35 cents an hour or whatever. But my whole summer wages went to one formal I used for 4th of July. It was quite an experience. After that, of course, they opened the cannery in Kasan, and we all worked there. I worked in fact, when I worked in Skullarm, I worked in just about every area. Piling cans, worked on the table, and I worked filling can covers, putting in can covers. So I worked in testing cans. I test cans upstairs and worked in various parts of the cannery at the time.
Were there enough people in Ketchikan in Kasan to be workers at the cannery, or did they?
No, all the women worked on the patch table. And that's about all the women they had there. There was Betty and Carolyn Young, and of course there was me and their mother, which was Eliza, and of course Julia, and my mother and Pauline. They ran two lines, and we all worked on the patch table, and of course it was all imported Filipinos. And that's why they had that, what we call the Filipino house. Huge building where they housed all these Filipinos. And of course when we worked long hours, we just invite ourselves. Instead of walking all the way home, we just walk right into the Filipino house, and they were more than tickled to see us. They'd be there with white gloves on, these canvas gloves, and of course we knew them all working in the cannery. So they'd see us and they'd come waiting on us just like we were really big time, you know, and we'd all sit down and we just loved their food with all that seasoning, with all that garlic and the different various seasons they use in Filipino cooking. It was really upper, everything we, you know, enjoyed in food. So that's where we got learned how to cook with I guess you'd say Filipino style. And use an awful lot of rice.
Right, right.
And even though we never went down there, they liked us so much, we lived right across there, and they used to give us great big gallon cans full of their leftover pork chops, and it'd always be flavored with all garlic and all the various Filipino spices. And they'd send it over to our place, with the bottom would be all full of fresh cooked rice, and they sent it over. I was thinking, I bet they thought poor little kids living over there. But we enjoyed it. I mean, you know, we got acquainted with, and of course Laura at the time, she didn't have a store, but she had a lot of pop by 20, 30, 40, 50 cases of pop she had. And of course that was a big deal. Everybody was going there to buy pop. You know, all the people, the Filipinos, and she did a pretty good job, I guess, just selling pop. And I don't remember what else she sold. She must have had candy or some other thing, but it was mostly pulp.
The fish for the cannery, did it, was it by just from the boats that were in Kasan, or were there other boats that were selling fish to the cannery?
That I couldn't possibly tell you. I couldn't say for sure. I could be mistaken, you know, by saying otherwise, but I know they brought in an awful, I don't know if it was during this time when they had traps or, but they had far too much fish to handle. They used to just dump it. They couldn't handle it. Cannery was practically running night and day, you know, and they used to just throw it all away. There was so much fish. And of course, same way with Carter Bay, it was just more than they could handle. People used to get all that salmon and bring it in. Of course, in our family, we didn't do it that way. I mean, there were a lot of other people that took too much salmon, couldn't handle it, brought it up on the beach and couldn't can it all, and consequently it was just all rotten, just spoiled. And of course, that's what, I guess, spoiled the spawning of the, to this day, I think, of the sockeye. You know, there wasn't just that much. They outfished it, you know.
Right. Did anybody fish there right in Kasan Bay for...
Pardon?
Did people fish right in Kasan Bay for different things, for eating or to sell?
They used to do, during the wintertime, they did a lot of... I remember my grandfather used to go out fishing quite a bit, and they'd bring in huge halibut and of course, a lot of red snapper, and they'd bring it in and just... bring it up on the beach and cut it up, and everybody from town would come and get their slices of halibut or whatever. They all shared their food supply, usually, always. Of course, there's a lot of deer hunting and various things. There's a lot of food that we prepared ourselves. You know, like my mother used to put in a big garden of carrots and radishes and peas and we had always had big patches of raspberries and strawberry garden.
Right around your house?
Right next to the house.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Strawberries and raspberries. So food was plentiful. I mean, we canned an awful lot of wild berries like salmon berries and huckleberries, blueberries. And then, of course, my grandfather owning the store, he'd buy... various like peaches and pears and they'd have boxes of he'd bring home and it would almost reach the ceiling that they'd have that much fruit that we had to can. And we canned an awful lot of fruit. Of course, fruit went with eating salmon, I suppose, various fish that we put up. They always, if you had boiled fish, you always ended up with your dessert was always canned fruit of some sort. So that's why they use an awful lot of canned fruit.
Yeah. I want to ask you about some of your memories of growing up in Kasan. Do you have any favorite?
You mean precious memories?
Yeah, precious memories.
Well, family gatherings, parties. They had, of course, parties was a big thing in not having TV or any other entertainment, but there was parties, usually always parties of some sort to celebrate New Year's, Christmas, and of course there was always a big thing with in the town hall for Christmas. I remember my dad putting up a big tree, and they tie all the apples on there, on the tree, and they had many, many social pie socials and various entertainment to raise money to buy toys for each child in Kasan. They all make sure everybody had a toy on the Christmas tree in Kasan, and everybody brought their gifts up to the town hall to be delivered. You know, we all went there, and there was an awful lot of people there, and everybody would go home with a big bag full of fruits of all sorts and bags of hard candy, and kids would come home with all their presents. And at the end of the party, I remember my dad climbing up this tree that they had put there with all the apples, and he'd just shake the apple tree, and all the apples would fall off, and everybody would grab all the apples, whichever, and the kids were just scrambling all over for the apples. And it was a big occasion, you know, they made a big thing of all their parties, whether it was a pie social or a Christmas party or whatever. And they often had home parties to celebrate either someone's... and there were, I guess there was a lot of Filipinos, not a lot, but say about 3-4 of them that stayed back that all played instruments. And they used to have various parties, and like in the Griffin's home, they had a big living room and they'd have a big party there. And I think it was more like a potluck. And the Filipinos would play, and they'd have an orchestra, a little orchestra there, and they'd play, and we'd all dance with whoever was there to dance with. But they had quite a celebration that way. I mean, a lot of entertainment with, they made their own entertainment that way. Like I say, in the town hall or the socials and home parties.
You've talked a little bit about some of the things you used to do as a little girl. Could you tell me what games you used to play besides, you said baseball?
We played baseball. Oftentimes, of course, it was always initiated by the teacher. I mean, she's the one that furnished all the balls. A lot of times the kids would hit the ball and it would go so far away that they never ever could find it in the bushes. So she always supplied more balls. You know, she was always ordering for balls to the dime store in Ketchikan so we could play baseball. And we'd play hide and seek, and we used to play stilts. I don't know if you're familiar with stilts, where we had Louis Thompson made both Julia and Laura and I, and stilts where they have a long pole with a place where you could put your foot, you know, and you're standing way up. You see it on TV. And we all had this, and that was a big thing. We used that, and that went on for a while. You know, it was just various stages of times when we had different things to play with. And of course, there was a period of time where everybody had a wheel, and still you can buy them that way, I guess, with a cross piece of wood with a handle on it, and you'd have a little wheel and you'd push it along. And whether there were big wheel, small wheel, but everybody entertained themselves that way. Of course, we had boardwalks in those days, you know. And we entertained ourselves by crawling underneath the streets to look for loose chains. Oftentimes we...
Okay, hang on. Oh, you're going?
Well, you talk about your store, your dad's store. What was the name of it? Did it have a name?
No. I think Louis Jones and that family had a store. Mm-hmm. And the only store name was Nelson's, which they owned. They had the post office in the back at that time. Of course, he sold everything besides groceries and toiletries like kerosene and gas and like that from the back. He sold just about everything. And in fact, he used to sell at one time, they had a lot of shoes. And I remember maybe 20, 30-year-old shoes we'd see with the buttons on the side. And he'd throw them all down the beach, and the kids used to pick them up and we'd play with them. And play always and use those shoes with the button shoes.
So we know how you got your food and some of your toys. How did you get your mail?
The mail boat was run by Fred. I forgot his name now. Fred. Funny, I mentioned his name the other night.
We'll find it.
Yeah. But anyhow, he had the mail boat. He'd bring the mail, of course, also brought our orders of from the store. You know, our groceries. Mm-hmm. And of course the whole town would come down to the dock to, everybody would be watching for the mailboat. And we'd all go down there and everybody would crowd down on there. And of course they'd hoist up the groceries and the mail. And then consequently we'd all meet at Annabelle. She's the one that, since Jack Nelson got sick and left, and his wife went back to Australia, I guess. So then Annabelle took over, and she was the postmistress for many years. And of course, she's the one that had the radio phone to communicate to Ketchikan in case we needed help for various things, anybody being sick or needed plane rides. She was always, they'd have to start up her motor to use the radio phone.
What kind of chores did you have as a kid growing up out there? In your
family? You mean the chores?
Yeah,
chores. Oh, packing wood and various things that... But it was mostly, usually, always playtime. There were so many in our family that we weren't expected to even learn how to cook. We never had the... I guess you would say the time, or there were so many women living, especially in our house, that we just were hardly expected to do much other than doing the dish. We took turns washing dishes, and if there's any wood or preparing a food, like working in the garden or picking berries, I mean, we all helped in. Everybody was, you know, there. Like I say, there was so many in our family that everybody chipped in to help. And I don't remember of anybody trying to slough off or not wanting to. It was just, we all made it a happy occasion to whatever we were doing, preparing. Like for preparing salmon, I mean, if there was salmon to be packed up, maybe the little kids were able to pack just one salmon. Or like coming from Carter Bay, when we had to go up the falls, we were able to pack just one salmon. And maybe the older people, they'd have a long pole and they'd put all their sockeye on there, and of course they'd take two men to pack down maybe 20, 30 sockeye at one time. And of course at that time they had to dip their salmon from Carter Bay, the river way up where we used to go. And I remember we had to cross over one time, and there was no way to cross over. There was a big lake what do you call those animals that make
Beaver?
Pardon?
Beaver?
Beavers. My grandfather took and tore down all their work that to let out all the water so we could cross over there. And then, of course, we got all our sockeye and we were ready to come back. And that thing was all... the place was all built back over again with the... So we had to do the same thing over again. But we used to have a lot of fun. Pauline used to be so afraid of... frogs. There was just frogs by the hundred, tiny little, about the size, not much bigger than your thumbnail. And we used to tease her, and we'd grab a piece of little rock and we'd throw it in her pocket, and we said, here's a little frog, Auntie Pauline, and she'd just scream and hold that little her little apron out, and she wouldn't touch it, and we'd go, oh, it's just a little rock, you know. And I guess consequently some people took some of those frogs, and they brought them to Kassan, and I heard there's some in Kassan. Because we noticed when I was there last time, there was various size of frogs that would jump out at us when we were walking down the road, you know.
I want to know again, of all the different things that you told us, what's the best thing you remember about Kassan?
The best thing that I knew about Kassan, or remembered about Kassan, is the social events with the mixture of all the young people and the older people. I mean, the younger children weren't segregated from the older people. We all seemed to gather and all celebrate different occasions all together. I mean, it was all a happy time for everybody. There was hardly any misunderstanding with as small as the town was, that you know, the people all socialized and everybody seemed to, you know, like one another.
Great, thank you. Now we can get to the little tougher questions.
Ooh.
These are the ones that you're going to have to think about a little more. As we're trying to relearn or remember a lot of our Haida, our Kassan Haida traditions, what do you think we should be teaching our children or our grandchildren about Kassan and the life you used to live there?
Well, I brought my daughter back there one time just to reminisce and to show her what we used to do when we lived there. Like, of course, I wanted her to see the totem poles that was moved over from Old Kassan. And sort of like we said, we were taking the tourist tour, so to speak, and doing everything like going down the beach and maybe building a fire, big, huge fire, and cooking bread by the open fire, making coffee down the beach, and so on and so forth. And what else could I say that the kids enjoyed?
Could you tell us a little bit about how you used to make bread down on the beach?
How do we make? Mm-hmm. It was just regular baking powder bread that they used, and they put it on a huge frying pan, and they put it right open on the open fire till it got cooked on the bottom. So then they were...
We were talking about bread.
Oh!
So all I could hear was airplane noises and bread once in a while.
Oh.
Could you explain a little bit about how you used to make bread on the beach?
We used to make bread like you would baking powder bread. I mean, without the shortening, evidently. I think I remember they didn't put shortening in it. And then, like I told you, they would take the... It would usually be a cast iron frying pan, and they put it right on top of the open fire. And then they'd cook it long enough so you'd able to handle the dough and turn it over. And then you'd cook the dough by the open fire. And then turn it over if you figured the bread wasn't cooked well on the other side. So eventually, it didn't take long, but the bread was cooked that way. And of course, we had the coffee pot going about the same time, and everybody made a big picnic of it, and we had our bread with coffee and whatever anybody brought down, kind of like a little potluck party, I guess you might say. So it was kind of a big social thing. Whoever wanted to come down in town, if they saw our fire, they came to join us or whatever. And another big thing we often did was everybody, there'd be some boat that would go out to get all the crabs, like I said, and would get a big tub full, and we'd have an open fire down on the beach, and we'd cook that, and lay boards on the floor, on the sand, and we'd take that all, after the crabs were cooked, we'd take it and dump it right on that, and everybody would just dig in and all have their all hot, fresh crabs, eat to their heart's content. And oftentimes we'd bake potatoes that way even. And of course right after somebody would go to Grindle, we'd have a Thanksgiving picnic, and they usually have it in the VFW hall, and the place is just overflowing, that it's so packed that it's surprising to know that there are so many Native Americans living within that area, you know, that would be interested to gather like that. And it's always a potluck, and there's always such a big showing of people within that area. And I'm surprised that there are so many people from our tribe that live within that area. It's usually in the Seattle, close by Seattle area.
Okay, I have just a couple more questions, unless you have anything. Okay. What I'd like to know is, what do you think is important to pass on to other people, that other children, my children? What do you think is important?
I would think of friendliness, like we share with the rest of our tribe, to make them aware of their Native American background, like our culture, that oftentimes fades away, I guess, from through the years. I guess, like I say, like people always say, like we've grown up in white man's ways, that we've all grown away from our Indian heritage. So oftentimes, of course, my kids, I have the son that attends all these dances, and he has his grandmother's Indian blanket, and he's very interested in our Indian background. And so is Sharon. I mean, she works over in Metlakatla as a teacher for the past 5 years. And she too is quite aware of our Indian heritage. So I think that's very important, being our children growing up knowing that they are, their background as Indians. because there aren't too many of us left, and of course our Indian language is fading away, especially our Haida. It's just a dying out language. Just the few that know the language are, of course, are aged, and after they're gone, I imagine our language would just disappear. I can understand Haida, but I can't speak it. And of course, my children don't know anything in the Haida language, I think, at all.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with an Indian story, Indilok, but I mean, he was talking about reincarnation. A lot of people, he mentioned this story, he said, this is a true story. He said people used to travel in canoes, and he said there was a family going someplace where they had never been before, like people usually travel to either get fish or looking for food and that sort of thing. And there was one little boy sitting at the end of the canoe, looking down at the water, and they were traveling, and he said, gee, he said, a few years ago, he said, let's stop up here. He said, I left a little boat, little canoe up here, he said. He said, I want to go get it. And of course, to pacify him, he fretted, and they finally, reluctant, they went up on the beach, and he ran right up, and he went up by the little stump, and he grabbed this little boat. It was all full of moss and everything, and he brought it back down. He said, this was my little boat, he said, when I was a little boy, he said. And of course, he was proving, my grandfather was proving that there was reincarnation, you know, that this little boy, they had never been there, but this little boy evidently, they said, had been reincarnated, that he had this little boy, little boat that he had put there, I guess, in a previous life. That was one of the little stories that my grandfather used to tell. And of course, he mentioned, they mentioned different stories about how various families used to have slaves. My grandmother had slaves. And he said where they got their slaves was, is that the boats used to come down here with the men in a canoe, and they just literally kidnap some people, I guess, and they'd take them back up and they'd have slaves. They'd keep them as slaves. And I was so surprised when I found out that my grandmother had slaves. And in fact, the ancestors of the slave that she had, I guess, lived in Heidelberg. I guess you remember, but I never mentioned it.
Want to pause?
And that's terrible. But I wouldn't mention them on a tape like this, because there's one of them that's going to have to be. Have you got it on?
Oh, I'll tell you.
You don't believe all those things anymore. I mean, witchcraft and all that. I mean, that's my belief. You know, it overshadows the belief of witchcraft and whatever that we were taught when we were little.
Is there, that's all the questions I have.
Okay.
But is there anything that we didn't talk about that you'd like to let us know?
No, I can't.
What I would think would be like when you were, how you were brought up, even though you were brought up in a Haida, you moved to a Tsimshian community, what that was like for you. I know it's not great thoughts, but, you know, it has some insight.
Yeah, how you as a Haida, because, you know, it's in Tsimshian country. I mean, the community is mainly Tsimshian, so how did you adapt and live?
Well, I had, my mother-in-law was a Haida, so she kind of steered me in the right direction, so to speak, being a Haida. And of course, her children suffered being Haida, that the Tsimshians, I guess, kids used to taunt the kids that they were Haidas and call them dirty Haidas. And so then Grandpa Lise, being a Tsimshian himself, he pounded on the kids when they all went away to college. He said, whenever you come back with your education. He said, don't ever apply for a job here in Metlakatla. He said, because you were so mistreated all these years, you know, that you should never, it would never lessen if you did get a job here, that you should always not have a job here, you know, being your Haida. But we adopted very well, I mean, as far as I was concerned. Even now when I go back, I go to the senior citizens and everybody, through the years past, everybody's hugging me and glad to see you and accept you. And to this day, I still have a lot of friends there that I used to visit with and socialize with while I was there. All wonderful people. In fact, like I say, Sharon lives there now, and she finds the same thing, that she finds that there are a lot of nice people. Most all the people that I know of, we've never had no conflict with any of the Tsimshians. And of course, my mother-in-law, all her friends were all people, all women that were remarried into the Tsimshian community, that like the Haidas and the Tlinkets, they all kind of stuck together, and they were all very close friends with Mrs. Lee being a Haida, that they were all her friends.
Okay. Who was the mother-in-law, the name?
Pardon?
The name of your mother-in-law.
Lillian.
Lillian.
It was her mother that was married to that preacher in Castello.
Oh, okay, yes.
And then the names of her friends that were the Tlinkets?
The Tlinkets was Mrs. Baines and Mrs. Davis and Marietta Benson, Cora Lang, and Lucy Booth. These are all the married names of all these various people of her friends. And there were all several others that I offhand can't remember. The only Haida man that I knew that married there was Henry Duncan. He was married to Francis Hanbury. And he adapted quite well. Of course, he owned a boat there and did quite well with socializing with the rest of the Tsimshian people.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Is that it, Sharon?
She's asking you if there's anything else you'd like to add. Something you want to add.
Is there something you would?
No.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you very much. I enjoyed your interview and the stories you had to tell us, and I really would like to say
how. And I'm glad for the interview myself. I never realized that I'd have this much to offer, being I left Kasan at such an early age. I left when I went away to Wrangell Institute and consequently got married right after. And I thought my short years there, I thought maybe I wouldn't have this much to help with the interview when they kept after me for this interview. And being the first one to be interviewed, I enjoyed both Honey, or Eleanor as people know her, and Jeannie. And I've made so many friends, and I've never seen my nephew Freddie for several years, and this too is a big plus to see him here as one of the operators of this interview. And I want to thank all of you for being so pleasant and so easy to deal with, and I've enjoyed this every minute. In fact, we could go on for two more hours. And I thank you all, for those that will be seeing my tape. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate all your effort. And you seem so dedicated that I just loved every one of you. And I thank you all.
Thank you.
How de guang.